Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Battle of Hastings and its aftermath nearly wiped out the leading families of Anglo-Saxon England. So what happened to the children left behind by this conflict?
A Times Best Book of 2022, Eleanor Parker's Conquered, The Last Children of Anglo-Saxon England, is now available for the first time in paperback and as an audiobook. From sagas and saints' lives to chronicles and romances, Parker draws on a wide range of medieval sources to tell the stories of these young men and women and the role they played in developing a new Anglo-Norman society.
Order your paperback copy of the book everyone's been talking about directly from the publishers, Bloomsbury, at www.bloomsbury.com/conquered, or start listening to the audiobook on Audible today.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark, and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Now, Lucy, it's the summer.
It is officially the summer,
I think. It's officially the summer, and we are doing the first of our summer roundups.
Summer specials. I like to think of it as something like the Beano, or insert favourite comic of choice. For me, it was definitely the Beano. You know, when you get the summer special and it's really exciting.
Yes.
I would like to hope.
Yes. It's just like that.
You think it's not like that?
You think of the Beano and I think of a summer special as a sort of end of the peer variety show.
Also very good. Yeah.
Yeah.
So actually we've set the bar far too high, I fear.
Far too high. But we have picked some of our favourites of the year thus far.
Yes, and things that go well together as well. So yes, a little chance to revisit some moments. And so if you're getting ready for your holidays, there's a number of things you've got to work out, such as, most importantly, what books to take, what to read. We made lots of suggestions in our summer reading roundup.
Brilliant suggestions, actually.
Brilliant suggestions, which I imagine everybody has immediately taken on board. But we also found a number of suggestions made by people, recommended by, wait for it, people like Ernest Hemingway and Philip Roth and Michael Chabon, F. Scott Fitzgerald, the sort of things that they recommended. So if you wanted to take some classics to the beach, we thought we'd help you out and tell you who likes what. What were you struck by? I have to say that we didn't do this research completely ourselves, did we?
Well, we didn't do it ourselves at all.
No. No, we didn't. No. We were helped by LitHub, shall we say.
We were, who have done the brilliant spade work of yes. gathering together all these lists of what people recommended and what writers read on their holidays and recommended themselves, and they've synthesized them and seen the crossovers. That's the interesting thing, isn't it? So when they thought, well, who, and this is the winner, this is the most recommended book, is Madame Bovary, which I must say, is that a holiday read?
Well, no, hang on a minute, Alex. I don't think they are holiday reads. I think we're just thinking about holidays. These are just books that are recommended by writers. So writerly books, if you like. So Madame Bovary's she's pretty much up there, isn't she?
I suppose she would. Well, she certainly was if you are Ernest Hemingway, or indeed Bret Easton Ellis, or Laurie Moore, or Claire Missoud or Mary Gateskill or Helen Fielding or Philip Roth. It's quite a broad church of writers there. They all recommended Flaubert's Madame Bovary. I mean, let's be honest, Proust comes second with In Search of Lost Time. And everybody recommends that, don't they? Doesn't mean they've read it. Sorry, Henry Miller. Don't sue me, Henry Miller.
Do you think they do? Do you think they're like, oh, you must read that? And then after that, maybe I will as well. Yes, no, he's, you know, he's usually up there. It's a good set of people, though, here. It's Michael Chabon, Harjin, Claire Massoud, Henry Miller, as you say, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Gary Steingart, and A.S. Byatt. That's a good list. That seems like, you know, if they think it's fun to read, I mean, they didn't say it was fun. If they think it's worth reading, though, I have to say, of course, they're not the first people to say that. Now, coming in third is someone, well, there's joint third for a lot of people, but the first joint third is Middlemarch, which is, you know, you've got to say would probably a bit of a given.
Well, Zadie Smith certainly thought so, we discover, as yeah. did Jennifer Egan.
And also tied, if you like, with George Eliot is Gabriel Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude, which is a bit of a blast from the past. I know that's a stupid thing to say. They're all blasts from the past. But it, I feel like, you know, that was very sort of voguish at one point and maybe went out of favour a bit. Does that make sense?
Well, maybe, but maybe also coming back because, you know, contemporary writers, I mean, writers writing right now, like Yagi Yassi, for example, have recommended 100 Years of Solitude. So, yeah. You know.
And so did Irvine Welsh, which is, you know, I mean, why not? It's a wonderful book, actually. I would love to read it again. And then another book you might have heard of, Ulysses by James Joyce. Take that to the beach.
Well,
I mean, you can.
You can, I suppose. But let's look at some of the books that are recommended that are less widely, you know, they're the less obvious things. They're not the Anna Karenina and the, you know, the Great
Pride
Gatsby.
Pride and Prejudice. Yeah,
and the Pride and Prejudice.
Enough.
You know, Bernard Malamud, for example, recommended by Jonathan Franzen and Philip Roth. Wonderful, wonderful writer. Perhaps not as widely read as he should be. Buddenbrooks, says Philip Pullman. I mean, he doesn't actually say Take It to the Beach, and I would say perhaps not. Zora Neale Hurston's fabulous book, Their Eyes Were Watching God. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a pretty amazing, amazing list. So tuck your Henry Miller recommended André Breton in your back pocket or your... Now, Donald Barthelme, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm not taking Journey to the End of Night by Céline anywhere, I don't think. Took it somewhere when I was 16 and that's me done.
There are also someone's recommending Henry Miller again, who seems to have recommended half the books, so maybe you're right, maybe he hadn't read them all, or maybe he had. He's recommending The Decameron by Boccaccio, which is pretty scholarly.
You know, I see a book here and it's reminded me of something that happened to me really, really recently. Gulliver's Travels. Oh, Henry Miller, here he is again. Couldn't stop recommending books, famous for it, but also Borges has recommended Gulliver's Travels. And I had recently a house guest and it was somebody I didn't know. They were coming to stay, a colleague of my husband's, and we hadn't met. And it turned out to be an enormous Swift fan and arrived with a gift for me. And the gift was an edition of Gulliver's Travels with illustrations by Arthur Rackham. Isn't that the most lovely thing you've ever heard of as a present? So much better than a bottle of wine.
You can get a bottle of wine anywhere.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm not saying don't bring a bottle of wine. Anyway, there we are. Food for thought.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And we've got more food for thought coming up, haven't we?
We have. So the things that we've been looking back to this week speak of both failure and mastery. Earlier in the year, we talked to Stephen March about his book on writing and failure. And we also talked to Nat Segnett, who had reviewed Adam Gopnik's book, The Real Work on the Mystery of Mastery. Enjoy our look back to earlier in the year.
It gave me comfort to know that, like, James Joyce couldn't get a job at a technical college, even after he'd written Dubliners, or that Herman Melville, you know, he wrote a better book basically every outing he went, and he slowly but surely sold less and less until he ended up, you know, unable to publish and self-publishing Civil War poetry in a zine. For some reason, it's those stories that have always given me comfort. And so I had a bunch of them in my head, and during COVID, I thought, I'm just going to stitch them all together and I'm going to figure out what connects all these stories of failure.
Well, you did. I mean, there's lots and lots of stories. I found this book extremely comforting. It was a sort of form of companionship, really. I felt from it. But you do more than that. You are theorizing, speculating, probing the edges of what this might actually mean, what failure might mean to us. You do say that you yourself kept note of your own rejections, but stopped when you got to 2000.
Yeah. And I mean, that was in my mid-20s. I think one of the things we're, you know, living now in a digital age is that you can accumulate so much more rejection because you can submit so much more widely. I mean, I can only barely remember, but when people actually used to send physical manuscripts to places with like self-addressed stamped envelopes and get them back, you know, it's very hard to accumulate a lot of rejections that way. But now, you know, I can write for the TLS, right? Which my father-in-law who lived in Toronto could not. So I can get a lot of rejections from the TLS, right? Or wherever. And so, yeah, I think we're living in an age where, you know, rejection has sort of spread exponentially with the internet.
It's sped up. It can be more immediate, as you
exactly.
said.
It can be more immediate, and it can just be a lot more common and more regular part of your life.
I have to say that memory of the physical that you've just brought up, the very first review I ever wrote was for the TLS, and I printed it out, of course, and I faxed it, I think, from, as we did in those days, a newsagent's shop. And then I didn't really kind of believe that the magic of the fax had worked, bear with me. And so I walked my copy round to the TLS offices.
Wow.
Belt and braces. It was such an enormous kind of honor. I thought, what if it just didn't get there?
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, my father-in-law, who was a freelancer like forever, I mean, he literally had his newspaper would send him taxicab chits, and he would send the manuscripts of his columns by taxi, you know, to the newspaper, right? And that meant, really, he could only be rejected within his city. He probably physically saw the faces of everyone who rejected him, right? Whereas, you know, I've been rejected by thousands of people that I will never meet physically or know in any other way. It's just a sort of different reality.
Well, it kind of begs the question that though, doesn't it? Is it in some way better to see the faces of the people doing the rejection? Or is there something really sort of psychically overwhelming by the thought of these great disembodied, faceless masses who might be rejecting you?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think, one of the questions of this book is now, is it harder now to be a writer than ever before? Or does it just feel that way? Right. I sort of have a yes and no answer to that, because I think we're kind of returning to the historical norm. I mean, there has never been a good time to be a writer. I mean, I think that's one of the lessons of this book, where you go through all this history and you realize, like, oh my God, like James Joyce never made a living doing this. Right. I mean, you kind of know that. But then on the other hand, you're like, that is ridiculous. Like, you know what I mean? Like that is just an insane fact. And the same thing goes for Herman Melville and so on. This is absolutely standard. Right. And I don't think our time is worse or better than any other time. It's just different. And I do think the digital stuff just makes it, you're facing more rejection, you're facing more failure, although, you know, they all faced a lot of failure. I mean, the book was sort of inspired by that George Orwell quote in the epigraph, which is, any life seen from the inside is nothing but a series of defeats. I mean, I just can't stop thinking about that line because it's so true. And, you know, I think that's true for everyone now, but it was also true, you know, in the 1920s or the 19th century or, you know, the second century AD.
Before we go back through history and this book, which is, you know, it's a compact book. It's absolutely stuffed with histories and writers with relative success and failure, largely failure. But very near the beginning, you hint at the idea that we see failure in a different way. And I was really intrigued by your report of something called FailCon, a conference where people, I mean, this is in a business context rather than a literary one, where people basically get together to kind of celebrate their failures. I mean, the idea sounds horrific to me, but there is a different sort of attitude towards defeats and failures, isn't there?
Well, I mean, you know, what I was responding to there is very specifically the tech lord mania for failure, which is actually, FailCon, I think, started in 2014, but I think it's actually peaking again now. I mean, people in Silicon Valley brag about their failures. I mean, it's humble bragging, you know, it's a backhand self-insult, I guess is the way to put it. But they're wrong. Like that version of failure that like, well, I failed at this first company, I did this startup and it didn't work, and that's why, you know, I've changed the world now by X. I mean, it's so transparent, right? It's so transparently, you know, value success over failure. Whereas I think when you read Beckett and he says fail better, he's talking about something different. You know, he's talking about failing with grace and failing with passion. And that's a much different, much more powerful idea, I think. I think one that resonates a lot more with writers.
Absolutely. And well, I might say that, you know, obviously there are enormously costly failures in publishing history, but by and large, when a writer doesn't make it, that's very painful and often penury inducing to them, but it doesn't tend to take down many thousands of shareholders, does it? I mean, there's rather sort of less at stake than there
is. Well, I mean, I think there's some wives and children of failed writers that would say it comes at a cost. But yeah, it tends to be, you know, and then the booze, you know, like, and that tends to add to the failure. But yeah, I take your point. This is a private failure. And the writing is, you know, I think that's also the power of failure in writing, is that it is sort of between these two privacies, which means that failure is kind of built into the process. I mean, that's what I found really interesting about writing this book, is that, you know, I had all these anecdotes that made me feel better. But then when I really started to think about it, I was like, you know, failure is such an integral part of this process that it's not just the career stuff and it's not just the rejection. It's that when you write, you're throwing out stuff. That's what writing is, really, is throwing out stuff that you've written that you now hate. Right. And getting to, you know, getting to the tiny little fragments that mean something to other people. And it's the process itself, that magical leap between privacies, that means that failure is kind of absolutely built into the process in a way that it is in no other activity, if that makes sense.
There is just no escape from it. And the number of writers, novelists perhaps in particular, that one talks to, that I've talked to in the course of interviewing them, who say at least that they cannot bear their previous work. I mean, they don't look at it. That's gone, that's done. They hope, you know, just to fail in a slightly less dreadful way the next time. I was very intrigued by so many of these anecdotes, but one in particular that stuck with me was that of Samuel Johnson, and just this idea of his failure double. It is something that chimes so much with us. It's sort of the other side of that, you know, don't you hate it when your friends are successful kind of thing. He had a much, much less successful contemporary who he looked to, didn't he, to think, well, I'm not doing quite so badly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, Savage was, and I mean, I really believe The Life of Richard Savage is the best thing Johnson ever wrote. And I mean, I think it's a total masterpiece. I mean, one of those, you know, extremely rare work. I mean, one of the greatest works of English prose ever written. But, you know, it's so obviously wrong, too. You know, when I read it for this book, I was like, he's so obviously justifying inexcusable behavior, right? And he's taking the side of a fraud, which you don't really think of as Johnson, right? You think of him absolutely as this person who tells the truth about everyone, even his friends. But this one friend, who was a complete screw up, you know, like he would borrow money, spend it all on clothes. He was drunk. He had these farcical claims to an aristocratic thing. He killed a guy in a brawl over a seat at a coffee house, which, you know, was entirely his fault. And Johnson excuses it all. Johnson forgives it all. And I think that kind of sense, that companionship in loss, right, that is so much of writerly relationships, it comes across so clearly in that book. If you read it as kind of, instead of the truth, as a lie, right? And yeah, I found it incredibly moving, actually, to read it again.
These pairings, I mean, frequently crop up through history and indeed in this book, Pound and Eliot, for example. And I recently read Matthew Hollis's biography of The Wasteland, and you're so struck by the detail of how incredibly preeminent and prodigious Pound was and how his star fell. And he was trying to help Eliot. He was worried not only that Eliot's genius be seen by the public at large, but also that he have the funds to live, that he find places to write, that he is constantly advanced. He is a sort of impresario at a certain stage of his career, Pound, and then it all just falls apart. Now, those sort of arcs of writers' lives are absolutely fascinating, and you are sort of led to think, well, is there something twinned in these two writers that one has to rise and the other has to fall somehow?
Yeah, I mean, I find the case of Pound to be just profoundly mysterious, really. because, you know, he was so huge. I mean, you really forget that. He was modernism, basically. I mean, it's not just the Wasteland. It's, he told E. Cummings not to write with uppercase letters. He, you know, he told Hemingway to cut adjectives. He got James Joyce published. I mean, he was, and then his own work, Imagism and so on. And then, like, he is it, really, in some, you know, very, a way that I don't think we have any analog to now at all. Like, someone who was absolutely at the center of literary culture in a totally dominant way. Then, you know, he writes Canto 72, which is about a heroic Italian peasant woman leading Canadian soldiers into a minefield and watching the Canadians blown up. And he just completely loses the plot, right? And then he enters a kind of hell, you know, like a Dante-esque hell where the crime is the punishment. And, you know, I just found his meeting with Ginsberg and Ginsberg's diaries is like the cruelest thing that could have happened to him, really. I mean, just so, so painful.
Tell us what happens.
Well, I mean, Ginsberg comes along, and Ginsberg is, again, a poet that we just don't have any analog for. I mean, Howl sold over 1 million copies, but Ginsberg's also at the center of fake Western Buddhism, like hipsterism, drug culture. Like, he's really at the origin point of this. I mean, he sees Pound, and then almost right after, he goes and sees John Lennon and Yoko Ono in Montreal recording Give Peace a Chance. I mean, he's really at the center of culture. And then he comes to Pound in, was it Milan? I think it's Milan. And he insists on loving him. Like, he insists on saying what a hero he is and spouting all this nonsense to Pound. And I mean, you're talking about Pound, who, you know, really knows Buddhism and really knows Chinese poetics in a way that Ginsberg would never, you know, never approach. And it must be horrible to meet a parody of yourself, right? It's like he's seeing a version of himself that is totally degraded intellectually, and it's the opposite of everything that he aspired to intellectually. And yet you have to affirm him because, you know, Ginsberg, whatever his flaws, was not a fascist, right? So it's this scenario, which is, you know, you really have to get to the details. Like, I mean, the scene of, like, Ginsberg playing the Beatles, early Beatles, to Ezra Pound and explaining to him how they're just like Beethoven. I mean, what could be worse for Ezra Pound to suffer than that?
You do go into, in the book, this specter of mental disarray, of madness, but you are very interesting about the idea of suffering as somehow an indicator of success, a corollary to genius. I mean, you're very skeptical about this, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I really think when you examine literary history, you know, what you see is that there's no thread at all, right? Like, great writers are, they come in all shapes and sizes. I mean, they really do. Like, they come in all different classes, they come in all different races, all different genders, they come in all different forms. You know, some of them are such prudes that they, you know, can't deal with women at all. Some of them are born in whorehouses, right? I mean, they come from all different walks of life. Some of them travel, some of them never leave the small village where they were born. There's just no pattern. And certainly I don't think suffering is required at all. I don't think suffering ennobles. But on the other hand, you know, there is a part of this where I think resistance is required, right? Where it's like, to write something meaningful, you kind of have to feel, they don't want to hear this, but I have to tell them. It's interesting because it's not just the stories of suffering writers that led me to that conclusion. There are plenty of those. But it's also that there are a few writers who get given everything and they stop writing, right? Like Ralph Ellison, who's a perfect example where, you know, after The Invisible Man, he really could have written anything and it would have been widely acclaimed and sold out. But he couldn't. He couldn't. And then there's other examples like the New Yorker writer who wrote Joe Gould's Secret, who, you know, they called the greatest magazine writer of his age, and, you know, he could never write again. So there does, you know, suffering is not necessary. But on the other hand, I think there is a part of this where perseverance is really a serious virtue. It's required in order to do this. Like, you have to be persevering in order to make meaning.
And sometimes, of course, the suffering, you know, which obviously suffering takes different forms, it exists to different degrees. Sometimes it does provide the material to which a writer can react, can take as their subject. I mean, you write about Anna Akhmatova, for example, who in her youth wrote entirely, you know, in more privileged youth, wrote entirely different kinds of works than famous Requiem.
You know, there was a case where it was the suffering actually affected the mode of writing. I mean, it was extraordinary.
Still to come on the show, Nat Segnit talking about the real work on The Mystery of Mastery by Adam Gopnik.
And if you've enjoyed the podcast this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to it for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
First things first, what does the title, The Real Work, what does that mean and where does it come from?
Well, it's from Magician's Shop Tool. So what it means is that once you've got the technique of, let's say, a close-up card trick under your belt, the real work comes when you add some magic to it. You make something that's merely efficient into something that's elegant and delightful. It's the superfluity essential to all art and human accomplishment, if you like.
And it's also crucially, it's not about being original, is it really? It's not the guy who devises the trick. It's the guy who sort of makes it beautiful and makes it work and makes the everyone go, ooh, ah, when they see it.
Precisely. So, yeah, so the trick itself is from the repertoire, essentially. But the real work comes in the individual magician, what the individual magician brings to it, what frills and furbelows and elegance he or she brings to it.
Mm-hmm. And because he was saying, he makes a point of saying it often starts with, he's quite specific, 12-year-old boys.
Yes, that's true. That is, it is, so it appears, quite a gendered activity.
More male magicians than female. But is it a kind of question of style, partly, or flair? Is it like the sort of equivalent of the garnish on the cheese souffle or whatever?
Yes, I think so. It put me slightly in mind of what John Updike said in defence of those apologists for what's sometimes called invisible prose. His prose, of course, being highly visible. His argument being that, you know, when we look at a painting, we are aware that we're looking at a painting, not at what is being depicted. And it's that style, it's that subjectivity, it's that sort of human imperfection, in fact, in some ways, that reminds us of what we're seeing and gives us the experience of art or of accomplishment or mastery.
Magic, he actually talks quite a lot about magic, doesn't he? It's quite unexpected. And even though he's not the one learning the magic, but that's his son learning the magic, isn't it, for a while?
That's true, yes. Actually, that's one of the things I rather liked about the book, is that as much as I admired the first chapter, which is about him learning to draw better, a glance at the contents page might give you a little kind of flicker of disappointment that it's going to be like one of those sort of Channel 4 series whereby Claudia Winkleman or something is given a challenge every week. But actually the book resists formula in that way, in that after that drawing chapter, he moves on to close-up magic from a slightly different perspective. As you say, it starts with his son's interest and kind of budding mastery of close-up magic, and then becomes a rather New Yorkery piece of kind of repertorial of the big schism in American magic between classicists, traditionalists like this guy, Jamie Ian Swiss, and the big showmen like David Blaine, who are really trying to erase the distinction between magic and performance art. So
then it becomes about sort of illusion and making you think about illusion and making you think about the kind of limits of human capacity, I suppose. I'm put in mind of, him lying in a glass box or submerging himself in water. It's that sort of death-defying feat kind of thing, isn't it? Rather than the rabbits out of hats sort of stuff.
That's right. But that forms part of what I think is a really excellent sort of analysis of the epistemics of magic, really, that Gopnik gives us. He conceives of it sort of via this guy, Jamie Ian Swiss, as an experiment in empathy, as a kind of contest of minds, so that magicians simply have a superior grasp of the way our minds work. And the secret to a trick might indeed be banal, extremely simple, but set up so that we as the viewer are unable to imagine it. So the magician leads us down an explanatory highway, as Gopnik puts it, from which there is no exit, or better still, from which there are six exits, all of them blocked. And that's where the mastery of the great magicians lie.
Mm. It's sort of in their theory of other minds, being able to feel, think about what you will feel and make you feel, wonder and awe, I suppose. That's what they're after, isn't it?
Precisely. And there's an American magician called Whit Hayden, who Gopnik quotes, saying magic is putting a burr under the saddle of the mind, which I thought was kind of nice.
Well, it makes me feel uncomfortable, that, though. I mean, I think it's supposed to, I suppose.
I think you are. It is a feeling of kind of delighted discomfort.
Yes. I've gone down a rabbit hole here now. Why are magicians all men, or largely men? Where are the female magicians? Why is it gendered?
He doesn't deal with that, does he, really?
Not at all. I mean, that really isn't touched on.
It's okay. It is interesting.
I'm just fascinated by it. But you see, it's also about trying to teach yourself things. Now, I've never, I must say, even as a child, I don't think, been tempted to learn a card trick. But maybe I should start to redress this kind of gender imbalance.
This gender imbalance, I think you should.
Well, I suppose the point is, traditionally, it's the woman is always getting sawn in half rather than doing the sawing, isn't it? I suppose that's the glamorous assistant. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Perhaps it's just that men are natural liars, I guess, and that it's really all about fraudulence and distraction and wrong footing the viewer or the participant. I don't know.
Utterly derailed us, Nat. I have utterly derailed us now. I'd improvise
all right,
now.
Right.
It's what we might call the real work. I've done the real work of the podcast there, of putting my own individual slightly chaotic stamp on it. But
yes,
it is about, isn't it, this book about learning stuff, about reaching a certain point in your life when you may think you don't have to learn anything else. But why not? Why not suddenly learn a language or something else?
Well, precisely. And there's a very nice point he makes towards the end, which is that he admits that he can take great satisfaction in getting a little bit better at the things he knows he'll never be very good at, driving, for instance. Whereas the one discipline he really has devoted his life to, the one thing that he has a shot at mastering, in other words, writing books like this, is a source of constant dissatisfaction. Because in achieving that level of near mastery, whatever you want to call it, he can see how far off real perfection is. So he says, we can do some things badly and still feel good about having done them, and some things well and still feel badly about not doing them well. But there's comfort in this. Equilibrium of mind is achieved by doing both.
Mm. I was wondering about that. He does talk about the role of the critic, doesn't he? And think about it in the chapter when he's learning to draw, precisely because he has worked as an art critic for a long time and feels a bit uncomfortable that he can't, you know, draw anything at all.
Well, yes, he feels pretty fraudulent criticizing stuff he's unable to practice himself.
Did any of that chime with you as a critic?
I really love that chapter, I have to say. It's a slightly different case to kind of, I mean, I suppose I could describe myself pompously as a kind of writer critic. So there's less of a distance between what I criticize and what I spend the rest of my time doing than
already.
Was the case with Gopnik. But he approaches it in a very interesting way, I think, because actually the majority of the art that he was covering as critic in New Yorker was conceptual, that had stored life drawing away in the attic. But in recent years, so he says, he's become more and more taken by the figurative, to pure craft, which, of course, he lacks entirely. He gets interested in the ancient tradition of atelier realism. So he apprentices himself to this, someone he describes as a real hard ass, a neo-realist painter called Jacob Collins, whose mission is to revive that old tradition without succumbing to sentiment or cliché. So he sort of walks the delicate line between classicism and reactionary grievance keeping, as he puts it. And so under this guy's guidance, he learns to look. He learns to see what he actually sees, Gopnik, that is, not what his teacher describes as the kind of predetermined symbol set of arms and torso and legs in the case of a life model, but shapes as Gopnik subjectively perceives them, just as we might, you know, see a weasel or a camel in a cloud. So he looks at a life model and sees, quote, a kind of hamster with soft rabbit ears where his shoulder joined his arm. And so I suppose it chimed with me to the extent that art is thus, life drawing is thus shown to be like every other discipline, a kind of slow carpentering of fragments into the illusion of a harmonious whole. And on the other hand, a kind of species of relinquishment, really, a kind of capitulation to feeling or instinct. So it's at once an effort of attentional focus that's also a letting go.
Yeah, I'm going to bring it down to earth a bit more by mentioning what his driving instructor says, who sums it all up, doesn't he, in one key piece of advice.
Become the noodle.
There you go.
You've got to become the noodle. We all have to become, we are becoming noodles ourselves. In our mastery of this podcast, but that's it.
Okay, I need that unpacked or cooked al dente or whatever it is. What is the noodle and why do I have to become it?
What his driving instructor, Arturo, appears to mean is concentrate and relax. And that's the trick to driving, in this case in Manhattan, which he's never been had the guts to do. And Arturo teaches him to concentrate very hard on the road in front of him, but also not to get too wound up about it.
I think Arturo absolutely does mean it. It seems to me Arturo is a very good teacher, isn't he? Because he gets driving in the middle of New York within, an hour.
Precisely, yeah. Yeah, no, it's an excellent bit of advice.
It's that the noodle is limp, Alex. So you have to not hold anything. You have to just sort of let go. And also be incredibly focused so that you don't die.
I see.
Is that helpful?
Well, it does seem excellent, you know, relax but pay attention advice that people give you in lots of, you know, it's like being told to calm down when you're feeling not calm. I mean,
exactly.
Easy to say, difficult to do, but I get the point. But going back to the drawing advice, it does seem to me that that more sort of empathetic, emotional kind of feeling sort of your way into something does sound more up my street than what I think of perhaps unfairly as the kind of more Gladwellian sort of 10,000 hours and geniuses and outliers and all that kind of thing. It seems more approachable and friendly in a way. Is that fair?
Well, coincidentally enough, I'm exactly 9,999 hours into my project to debunk the 10,000 hour thing. Catch me at exactly
nearly there.
Imagine if it all fell apart now.
Well, that's again one of the great strengths of the book, which is that Gopnik is kind of open to that way of thinking, in that he conceives of mastery as achievable via a series of kind of micro achievements, which, you know, and once you achieve some kind of competence, then those micro achievements kind of flow into one another, into this. He compares it rather pleasingly to the phenomenon of persistence of vision in cinema. It's lots of little moments smoothed over to give the illusion of continuity. But that's on the one hand. But on the other hand, he's still kind of open to the mystery, as the subtitle suggests. He avoids that sort of tedious and mechanistic and inherently sort of neoliberal idea of making everything measurable and acquirable, like an MBA, by not explaining away the mystery of mastery, by leaving some element of mystery preserved.
He's also got that lovely thing in terms of specifically of the 10,000 hours. He says that thing about that we look at the people who are absolutely outstanding in their field, and we think, well, they've done their 10,000 hours and they're marvellous. But actually, he says there are lots and lots and lots and lots of people who are also really good at it. We know three chess players, but there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of really good chess players. And that's just as valid as the three champions that we know. And it's the same whether you're talking about cooking or drawing or chess, or which I think is a very good point. The Beatles or, you know, Michelangelo or whoever it is.
Well, precisely. But also importantly, in the case of the Beatles and Michelangelo and Roger Federer, I mean, I don't want to watch them and think, yeah, well, they've just put in their 10,000 hours. I want to be floored by them. I want to be rendered awestruck by their God-given talent. So, I mean, reading something like Outliers, which, you know, popularized the 10,000 hour theory, I felt a bit like, do you remember kind of Dotty in Tom Stoppard's Jumpers, who is heartbroken that men have landed on the moon and thus killed its poetry? I conceive of the 10,000 hour theory like that. You know, leave the mastery alone, both for those people who are distinctly average at everything like me, and for, you know, the world's handful of geniuses.
Now, but I think, does he have something to say for, I mean, Gopnik or any of the people that he talks to about the, in defence of the average, as it were? Because there's quite a lot of things I'd like to have a basic competence at, you know, that they would be useful to me, or I might just get pleasure out of doing them. Learning things, particularly as you go on through life, I mean, it doesn't always have to be a matter of acing, does it?
Precisely. No, and that, as you know, as I mentioned, that's sort of where he ends up at the end of the book.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Stephen March and Nat Segnet.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardy and helped this week by Alex Lee.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.